Good morning. All right, the next case we've got on docket this morning is docket number 79921, Somerset Owners Association versus Somerset Development Company. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Schreger, do you want to reserve any time?
At this time, Your Honor, I would ask for 2 minutes of rebuttal time at the close of our initial discussion.
Okay, very good. Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Good morning to the courts. Please, the court, my name is Bradley Schreger, and I represent the appellant, Somerset Owners Association, in this action. I won't belabor the facts. I think they are sort of well known to everyone. A short synopsis. In the Somerset Association, there are currently 13 miles of collapsing rockery walls that are failing at the moment and will continue to fail over a long period of time. According to expert declarations in the case below, the walls were not built to specifications or to plans for a variety of engineering reasons that I understand sort of vaguely, but I certainly understand that there is a dangerous condition running throughout the community and that it will take many years and much money to monitor, maintain, and to repair. Now, to this, Your Honors, respondents, at least as a threshold argument, don't say, no, that's not true, but rather that the association was too late in bringing its suit. The district court agreed with respondents, and so here we are, in an appeal centering on the timeliness of the suit. Now, this inquiry, primarily surrounding issues of the statute of repose, raises a number of interrelated but not necessarily interdependent questions, all of which appear to be in the nature of first impression questions for this court. So let's start with the two issues that spring directly from the statute of repose inquiry, which are first, how do we establish the date of substantial completion of the project, and did the district court get it right in its analysis? And number two, under the facts and circumstances of this particular case, is NRS 11202, the statute of repose, is it subject to tolling, or more probably here, estoppel? And I will note, Your Honors, that the video of the clock has there. Thank you very much. Okay, so let's begin with substantial completion. As everyone knows, statutes of repose begin to run on the date of substantial completion of an improvement to real property under NRS 11-2055. Any analysis of a statute of repose, whether it applies or whether it's run, as well as any analysis of a statute of limitations, necessarily begins with a determination of the date the pertinent statute began to run. Now, it's important that we focus on this because it's the actual date that's necessarily has to be determined by the court to determine when it ran and when, for example, it has expired. It's not an era or a season. We need a date as best as can be possibly established. Now, this is not a picayune requirement. The statute, 11-2055, expressly requires it. It's in the title of the statute. It says, it sort of uses the date of substantial completion three or four separate times. It is necessary to establish that date. In fact, I was over the weekend, I was reading through this court's recent decision in Dykema, 132 Nevada 832, 2016 case. And in that case, the establishment of the actual date was, in fact, what the case turned upon, because the recording, as opposed to the issuing of a notice of completion, fell in between the two dates. For one of the appellants in that case, it was a period that could have been measured in a matter of hours. So it's necessary to establish when substantial completion was achieved so that we can understand the statute of repose in an application to any specific case. Here, the district court didn't do that, nor was it supplied with the date by respondents. Now, under 11-2055, there are, under paragraph 1, there are three documents that could necessarily establish the date of substantial completion with relative objectivity: the final building inspection, the notice of completion, or the certificate of occupancy. It is undisputed in this case that we have none of those three, none of those three documents that would establish with certitude the date upon which substantial completion is to be established under law.
Why isn't Mr. Schrager, why isn't the 2006 certifications from Stantec on the walls sufficient to establish that date?
Well, it is certainly true that you know those certifications exist. They are not, number one, they don't fall under any of the three categories. And number two, it was never argued that, it was never argued below that those certification letters established it. And the district court didn't accept those as establishing it. So for those reasons, unless you're going to claim that under the common law, that's where you look. The legislature has said these are the three documents we need to establish the certitude and objective dates. So the Stantec letters don't achieve that, and the district court didn't hold that they did. Because we don't have those documents, under paragraph 2, we turn necessarily to the common law in a catch-all provision. Now, the fact that the legislature, in the absence of those three documents, points us to the common law is not a particularly helpful guidance to us. But I need to point out to the court just how rare the situation we are in is. Because in almost every instance, you will have one of those three documents. It stands to reason. Most developers or declarants or builders are going to want to file those, and there's a particular ease in doing so because it establishes and begins the clock running for your statute of repose. The fact that we don't have that is incredibly rare. And the fact that this is an issue of first impression, trying to find a common law standard for substantial completion 20 years after this catch-all was put into place, even with all the building that's been done in the last 22 years since the statute was enacted, indicates that it's incredibly rare. In fact, in the Dykema case, it points to legislative history, and I point this out only for edification, in which the catch-all provision was sort of tacked on there in the expectation that it would rarely, if ever, be necessarily invoked. And yet here we are.
Mr. Schrager, it is in the statute that the common law, in the event those three criteria aren't met, would apply. Yes. And it seems to me from the briefing that you all appear to agree that the AIA definition sets out the common law with respect to that. Is that fair?
It is not entirely fair because that's not what the district court found. And beyond that, I think we would apply it in different ways, even if we did come to that agreement. The district court, you know, was charged with finding what this establishing a common law standard, and obviously this court will have to fashion a standard as well. And while I don't know if you will accept the AIA standard that we're urging, or at least in the way that we're urging it, I absolutely think that the contract standard that the district court reached for is inapposite. What the district court said was that substantial completion implies that the parties have been given the object of their contract and that any omissions or deviations can be remedied. This was taken specifically from Amjur Second Damages explaining contract substantial performance. We think this is out of place because that has very little to do with the work itself. Right? This is not a contract case. There may be contracts involved in construction, but what the AIA standard points to when it says substantial completion is the stage in the progress of the work when the work or designated portion thereof is sufficiently complete in accordance with the contract documents so that the owner can occupy or utilize the work for its intended use. And that's the part that the district court failed to honor. It's essentially a fitness standard. If I have contracted for a particular product, a particular construction, and you haven't, for example, had a final building inspection or a notice of completion or a certificate of occupancy, you are in essence at the mercy of arguments to the common law that relying upon your work. You are standing upon your work, right? Now, below, the court was much taken with respondents' arguments regarding, well, if we accept that, a fitness-based argument, it will leave open for decades the possibility of these kinds of suits. The statute of repose will never run.
So you're putting in fitness into the AIA definition. You believe that it, if you're going to go under the common law, that you use the AIA definition and insert that it must be fit and according to contract requirements?
Well, I think it's that fitness is built into the definition. It's so that the owner can occupy or utilize the work for its intended use. To me, a shorthand for that is it must be fit so that I can occupy or use it for its intended use. You're right that the word fitness doesn't exist there, but in the same way, the word repose doesn't appear in the statute of repose. The fitness is implied because that's essentially what it's saying. Now, as I pointed out, one thing that the district court made clear is that it felt that standard was going to stretch out statutes of repose ad infinitum forever. That's the sort of statement that I think sounds damaging to my position as an initial matter, but upon examination really isn't, because number one, that would be incredibly rare, even rarer than the situation we're in. And beyond that, any declarant or builder would have it within their immediate power to not be in that situation by simply filing a notice of completion as contemplated by the statute. You would think you would want to do that at the earliest possible moment because that, in essence, starts your statute of repose. In any case, whatever standard this court adopts, and I don't think it's the district court standards, but whatever standard does emerge under the common law, it may in fact be difficult to immediately derive from that an objective date of substantial completion. In that instance, which I think is likely, is an issue of fact for the jury that would preclude summary judgment. And so it's our position that not only did the district court not establish the appropriate date, also not utilize the appropriate standard, but that in doing so, at the end of the day, it's a genuine issue of material fact when the date was, whether it's been, if the date even exists, if substantial completion hasn't been complied with.
Mr. Schrager, you're running out of time. Yes. And I had another question on kind of a different subject. But
certainly.
The 2011-202 was amended in 2019. And I want to be clear, you brief and argue this case under the 2015 version of that statute. Is that correct?
Yes, as it turned out, in their diligence in filing their suit, the association has fallen into the interregnum between the 2015 amendment, which did have a tail into 2016, but before the adoption of the 2019 statute. So, in a stroke of very bad luck, it falls into that category.
So, and are you alleging fraud against the declarant?
We have no evidence at this moment of fraud, Your Honor, but it's interesting that you raise that because it takes me to my next point regarding the possibility of estoppel. We don't have that evidence, but we also never got to that stage of the proceedings. So, I certainly cannot make that charge here and wouldn't. It's not impossible, and it goes to show, I think, that, you know, one would be forgiven in reading the briefs and attending court below in thinking that statutes of repose are somehow inviolable super statutes that are impregnable with tensile strength no one can touch. I don't think that's true. I don't think it's borne out by the law either. This question may be new here. Statutes of repose are to be respected, but they're not inviolable. In fact, the only real qualitative difference between a statute of limitation and a statute of repose is their triggering events, right? One is based on injury, the other is based on completion. So they should be respected, but where they can be manipulated in a manner that utterly destroys a party's right to seek redress for its injury, as here, courts should act in equity to prevent the injustice. So, you know, Your Honor brings up fraud. I think, Your Honor, this court would not permit fraud or criminal conduct or a conspiracy under a statute of repose to continue to run. And once you accept that statutes of repose are not inviolable, and they can, in fact, be estopped under particular circumstances, the question becomes, what circumstances are we talking about? The circumstances here is when the declarant's extended control utterly wipes out the possibility for the association to bring a suit. Not only has the declarant gotten way too much of the bargain of a statute of repose, the association has gotten none of it. I mean, respondents argue that, well, if you agree with us, you will have destroyed the policy and the purposes underlying the statute of repose, which are peace of mind, unfair surprise, stale evidence.
Mr. Schrager, aren't you really saying that? You're saying that they should have a jury trial to determine when they were substantially completed so that then the court can make a legal determination whether or not the statute of repose bars your lawsuit.
Justice Silver, that is correct on that issue. We are also arguing that during the period of declarant control, they should be stopped from arguing the statute of repose on that basis alone. Either of those paths get us where we need to be independently.
Okay, Mr. Schrager, thank you. You chewed up your rebuttal time, but I'm going to...
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, Your Honor.
Well, I'll give you go ahead and give you a minute. I'll ask you a few questions, and I'll add a minute to Mr. Christensen's time as well.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Justice. I am Ted Christensen, and in this case, I represent Stantec Consulting. I also have with me Ms. Natasha Landrum, who represents Q&D Construction, and Mr. Charles Burcham, who represents Summerfield Development Company. And on the screen is Mr. Steve Castronova, who represents Parsons Brothers Rockeries. I'll be taking the argument for all of the respondents. There's a few issues I want to get to today, but I think most importantly is the notion of substantial completion, as well as the equitable tolling argument. I'm going to start with substantial completion because that was the bulk of what was discussed in Mr. Schrager's argument. I think it is fair to say that the parties essentially agree on what the common law definition of substantial completion is, and whether you use the definition that that the association put out in its briefs, or you use the definition that the respondents put forward in their briefs, or whether you use the district court's definition, they are in effect the same. And that is, substantial completion is merely a stage in the process of construction where the improvement gets to a point where it can actually be used for its intended use. Fitness for its intended use or fitness for a particular purpose is not an element of substantial completion under any definition found in the common law. It is important when analyzing substantial completion to realize who has the burden. There is the case G&H Associates, which discusses the purposes of statutes of repose and how statutes of repose basically give vested rights to contractors, designers, developers, etc., to not be sued after a certain period of time. And because you're talking about vested rights of the defendants, it's incumbent on the party making the claim to not only prove the elements of its claims, but also to prove that these claims were brought within the applicable statute of repose. Here in the district court, we bifurcated discovery. And the first phase of discovery was focused on the statute of repose issue, which necessarily gets to substantial completion. As Mr. Schrager mentioned, there's nothing in the record to indicate that we have a certificate of occupancy, which for a rock wall, you're never going to have anyway. We don't have anything in the record of a final building inspection, and we don't have anything in the record of a notice of completion that was recorded by the owner. So we move on to substantial completion, and we must look whether these rock walls were at a stage in the construction where they could be used for their intended purpose. One of the justices, and I'm sorry my screen is a little bit small, I don't know which one it was, but there was a question about whether the Stantec certificates can act as a essentially evidence of substantial completion for these walls. And absolutely they can. Now those certificates may not be one of the three documents that establishes an objective date, but those documents are evidence that these walls were fully and finally complete. And when you go to those documents, you can see that not only were the walls fully and finally complete, there was no more work to be done. The legislature has a definition of final completion that is in Chapter 108, which deals with mechanics liens. But under Chapter 108, a project is fully and finally complete when there is a cessation of work coupled with an acceptance by the owner. In this case, we had acceptance by the owner, Somerset Development Corporation, and a cessation of work by all the contractors, whether it was Q&D, Parsons Brothers, or whether with Grantech doing the observation of the construction and the final certifications. Logically, a project cannot be fully and finally complete, and or a project can not reach a stage of final completion but not yet be substantially complete. Substantial completion is something that is necessarily equal to or less than final completion. The engineers hired by the association acknowledge the correct definition of substantial completion, again, a stage in the process, but then they use a different definition in order to create an issue of material fact. And those engineers say these walls, because they are expected to last 50 years, cannot be substantially complete if they are designed or built in a way that they will not last 50 years. But we have to look at what that does to the statute of repose. It essentially eviscerates it. And the association admitted in oral argument at the district court that if we are under the common law definition of substantial completion, that a building could be in use for 45 to 50 years prior to someone bringing a claim. And all a claimant would then have to do is hire an expert witness to say, well, this building was built defectively and therefore isn't fit for its intended use. In other words, using fitness for an intended use, which is warranty language from the Uniform Commercial Code, necessarily eviscerates the statute of repose. I'd like to move on and discuss the concept of equitable tolling and equitable estoppel.
But before you do, I have a question, and it's something that your friend across the aisle alluded to, and that is that the statute lists the three normal ways you're going to get the statute of repose triggered, and then has this fallback about the common law on substantial completion. What do you say in response to Mr. Schreger's argument on that? And therefore, we should interpret it narrowly as opposed to open-endedly. I mean, he's saying essentially that that would just swallow the rule if we accept your position.
Well, again, when you talk about the three normal ways to establish substantial completion, I agree with Mr. Schreger that this is a very rare instance. But what we have here are rock walls that are not buildings where you would have the city inspectors come in and issue a certificate of occupancy. But the common law definition is a way for the legislature to say, we understand that not all three of these or not even one of these items may be available in some cases. So in that point or in that instance, we will go back and we will use the common law definition of and frankly, the common law definition of substantial completion will most likely get you an earlier date to start the running of the statute of repose, because if you have a certificate of occupancy, that may be done well after final completion. You may have a notice of completion that is recorded by the owner a month or two after the project was substantially complete. But what the legislature is doing by providing us a catch-all is basically saying, in case we don't have any of the documents, there is still a way to determine the date of substantial completion. And if you survey the multiple states, many of the states have their statutory definitions of substantial completion. So reverting to the AIA definition of substantial completion is a fair way to get to that definition. Now, notably, in the AIA definition, it contemplates that the work of improvement will not yet be fully and finally complete, and that that work of improvement may have problems. There may be defects that need to be remedied, but under the AIA, you establish a date of substantial completion for payment purposes, and then the contractor must produce a punch list or some other type of list indicating what work remains to be done, although substantial completion has been approved. With equitable tolling and equitable estoppel, the association's arguments are based on a false premise, and that false premise is that it was the period of declarant control that prevented the association from bringing its claims timely. It's undisputed in the record that the period of declarant control ended in January of 2013, but according to the association, the impetus for this suit was the failure of Two Walls in, I believe it was February of 2017, more than 4 years after the declarant turned over control of the association back to the homeowners. In 2013, and this is really important, in 2013, we had a 10-year statute of repose. That did not change until AB 125 was passed in 2015. I believe that was passed in February of 2015, and it became operative immediately. That reduced the statute of repose to 6 years, but AB 125 had a one-year savings provision and provided that if a claimant brings a lawsuit within 1 year of the passage of AB 125, that claimant could utilize the 10-year statute. So in this case, and under this record, what we have is declarant control ending in 2013, 3 years where the association could perform investigations, do an analysis of the rock walls, and bring a lawsuit and be safe under the 10-year statute. But there was no evidence in this record that the association did any, no evidence in the record of any investigations performed by the association, no evidence in the record of any inspections conducted by the association or any communications between the association and the declarant indicating that there may be a problem with the rock walls. Again, it was the failure of two rock walls that occurred in 2017, which was the impetus for this suit. So even if this court makes new law and says that equitable tolling can be used to defeat a statute of repose, it can't do so under these facts, whether we're talking about tolling or equitable estoppel. And the association never really analyzed the factors under equitable estoppel, but contrary to tolling, equitable estoppel deals with an affirmative action by the defendant that either prevented the claimant or convinced the claimant not to bring its case timely. We don't have any of those facts in this record to apply equitable estoppel. But the general notion with equitable estoppel and equitable tolling to defeat a statute of repose is simply isn't allowed. This court has never applied equitable tolling to a statute of repose, and the majority of states do not apply equitable tolling to a statute of repose. Now, obviously, this court and others can apply equitable tolling to statutes of limitations, and recently in the Fausto versus Sanchez-Flores case, this court did just that. And in the Fausto case, the court discussed the purposes behind the statute's limitation. And the court did the same thing in a case called FDIC against Rhodes, where the purpose of a statute of limitations is simply to encourage a plaintiff to bring its claims timely. And therefore, if something prevents that plaintiff from bringing the claims timely, it's not contrary to the purposes of the statute to apply equitable tolling to allow that plaintiff the opportunity to bring a claim. Statutes of repose, on the other hand, focus on a different actor. Statutes of repose reflect a legislative judgment that contractors, developers, designers should be free from liability after a certain period of time. So when the court analyzes whether to apply equitable tolling, the focus needs to be on the vested rights of the defendants to not be sued, rather than the actions or something that happened to the plaintiff to prevent that plaintiff from filing suit.
Do you have any comments on the 2019 amendment to NRS 11202 and the addition of subparagraph 2, which seems to allow for sort of tolling by virtue of fraud? Do you have any comment on that as it may apply to the proper interpretation of the 2015 version on the issue of equitable tolling?
Absolutely. The legislature made a determination in 2019 that it would allow essentially tolling, or that the statute of repose is simply not going to apply in cases of fraud. It's a clear expression of the legislature's intent to essentially carve out an exception to the statute of repose. And there are other exceptions in the statute of repose as well that are in NRS 11.202. They don't apply to claims for indemnity or contribution. They don't apply to innkeeper liability. And those are clearly legislative expressions of intent to exempt those types of cases from the statute of repose. But notably,
Do you take the position, and I didn't really see it in your briefs, but I kind of, it's hinted at, that the expression of one thing is the exclusion of another. In other words, the legislature's carved the exceptions to the statute of repose. It stated them, and therefore this court should not go further.
Absolutely. And my Latin is so bad that I'm afraid to say it while I'm publicly speaking. But yes, that is the argument, is that the legislature, when crafting these statutes of repose, has made a legislative judgment that certain items aren't going to be subject to the statute of repose. And if the legislature had intended to exempt issues where the declarant controls an association, the legislator would have expressed that intent in NRS 11.202 or NRS Chapter 116. And I am running out of time quickly, and I wanted to talk very quickly about Chapter 116. The association has made the argument that NRS 116.3111 holds the statute of repose for this case. However, .3111 holds statutes of limitations, and by its plain language, only applies to statutes of limitation. And there is a North Carolina court that has interpreted that exact same provision, and that is, and I apologize, it's not in the briefs, but it's the Glens of Iron Duff Property Owners Association against John Daly, and that's 224 North Carolina App 217. And I realize I have run out of time, so unless there's any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right, colleagues, any questions? All right, thank you. Mr. Schrager, 1 minute.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Two quick points, one involving the Stantec letters. I struggle to sort of understand what the rule you could derive that would permit the Stantec letters to stand in for the other documents, sort of establish substantial completion, especially when this court in Dykema said it isn't just the issuing of the three documents, it's the actual recording. Here you'd be setting out a rule saying, as long as somebody writes a letter with a date on it saying we're done here, you have substantially completed. I don't think that's appropriate. And beyond that, it would seem to me that if they want to bring that before a jury so that it can decide that that's appropriate, they can do so. Secondly, on the warranty issue, I want to say this. Yes, 116.3.1.1 says any statute of limitation. But there's many ways to read that. And one of the ways in which I think the legislature indicates that what it means by that is any period of limitation is in 116.4.116 when it points back to that very statute and uses the phrase the period of limitation, so that in the end, reading holistically and harmonizing the warranty claims made by my client survived because they were told the statute of repose and limitation would have been told under the combination of 311 and 4116.
All right, colleagues, any other questions for either attorney? Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate your fine briefs and your arguments today. This matter will stand submitted. We will stand in recess until...